This is Dick Buescher, and we're discussing ecological, personal, and spiritual relationships. Yeah, that's interesting. There's a wilderness teacher, philosopher, kind of self-appointed guru, that posed that wilderness was not a place, that it was a place in the mind of humankind. And he strongly espoused that. Made lots of speeches at wilderness conferences on the subject, and most recently I've got the book upstairs, and where he has now decided it's a place too, and that it is a natural condition as well as a mental condition. I think I have to expand my sense of what wilderness is and personalize it, because I've been connected with the wilderness movement, which is the legal side of America's decision to set natural condition lands aside, 5,000 acres and greater, which are preserved, and I'll come back to that ornery word, that are preserved in the natural condition. And I've been so involved in the studies and the legal process and testifying before Congress and every step of the way to achieve a wilderness system that, in fact, that tends to give rather tight sideboards in my mind to what wilderness is. Wilderness is a place on a map with a boundary around it which says you are now in wilderness. In fact, I know that I can find wild places, which I've started to call it, almost anywhere. There's a great opportunity. It's the things that I think collectively you've said. It is your reaction to surroundings, your sense of being unfettered is the wonderful word that was coined for the Wilderness Act. Untrammeled, not being confined by a trammel, which is a fishnet. But the derivation of the word is a little bit interesting. Wilderness is, in the Teutonic tongue, is a place of wild beasts, and was seen to be outside of the control of that society, Middle European, dangerous, threatening. If you go to some of the Bible references, then you get that same feeling that this was the wild place, the scary place, the place where bad things would happen to you. But if you pursue, as we've done in other retreats here, with people that are far more informed on Scripture than myself, there's also a lot of other suggestions that wilderness is much more than that, and Scott referred to some of them last night, that in fact Christ found it a place to get within himself, God supplied to the people that would experience the wilderness, basic needs. So there's, you know, like almost everything in Scripture, you can find a very expansive definition if you pursue it. I think what's important here to us in this pursuit of the question of finding God in the wilderness, and therefore I think finding ourselves, and probably finding ourselves first to find God, is that it is a place of opportunity, and that we can only seize that opportunity by learning to see, by learning to perceive, to learning to smell, to feel, to touch, to embrace wild places and the things of wild places. I'll take in a little different order with the ecological relationships last as I see them. But first the personal, and I will be personal. I'll share my own experience and then that of my wife and my family in very short examples of the personal relationships that I see that can develop as a result of experiencing wilderness, because it's not only looking within yourself. And then I'll go to spiritual relationships, which I mentioned last night. I've always experienced, but I've begun to give lots more thought to, and maybe some verbal definition to what I think some of those are. And then lastly, I'll talk about ecological, because that sets the stage for the walk that we'll take after the break. And I'll talk about ecological relationships and maybe even some rules for you than Buescher's rules of travel in the wilderness that are different than what are taught in books on backpacking and the like. I would like to take, though it'll take 14 minutes of our time, and we don't have a lot, I'd like to take the time to show you a video that we developed for this event, which was the 25th anniversary of the passage of the Wilderness Act, because it quotes some really super people, and because it includes some beautiful photography that evokes some of the feelings I think we all develop, whether a visitor to wilderness or not. And it does quote the act, and so you get the poetic language of the Wilderness Act, and there are very few laws in the United States one would describe as poetry. And the Wilderness Act, at least the definition of wilderness in the act, is one of those, and it comes very early in the tape. This was done by myself contributing photography and some of my comrades, but it was done by a young man in terms of assembling it into a really beautiful program, including selection of music by a young man named Tom Arachi, who I work with, who's a photographer on the Mount Hood. And I think you'll see that it sort of collectivizes our experience of those beautiful natural places that we call wilderness. We make all this high-tech work.
Population, accompanied by expanding settlement and growing mechanization, does not occupy and modify all areas within the United States and its possessions, leaving no lands designated for preservation and protection in their natural condition. It is hereby declared to be the policy of the Congress to secure for the American people of present and future generations the benefits of an enduring resource of wilderness. For this purpose, there is hereby established a national wilderness preservation system to be composed of federally owned areas designated by Congress as wilderness areas. And these shall be administered for the use and enjoyment of the American people in such a manner as will leave them unimpaired for future use and enjoyment as wilderness. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. Humanity, but out of the need to experience my humanness the more vividly, I confront in stretches of the earth that my kind had no part in making. Thank you. But indeed, it is not so much for its beauty that the forest makes a claim upon men's hearts, as for the subtle something, that quality of the air, that emanation from the old trees, that so wonderfully changes and renews the weary spirit. It is the great moral spa. It is the best place in the world to bring an old sorrow that has been a long while your friend and enemy. With every hour you change, the air penetrates through your clothes and nestles to your living body. You forget all your scruples and live a while in peace and freedom, and for the moment only.
Thank you.
nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees. The winds will blow their freshness into you and the storms their energy, while cares will drop off like autumn leaves.
give some definition to wilderness, I think, for all of us. By the way, Scott, that tape now belongs to Holden Village.
Really?
Well, I feel obliged since all the deer in there came from Holden. And they're so cooperative. Also, the mountain goat came from that return trip I mentioned for the people of the retreat 2 years ago, and we did the backpack trip up here in Pyramid Mountain. And that early morning, I walked them up, and they were all prepared to look down into the depths of Lake Chelan from a mountaintop and to see mountains running clear to the Canadian border. And that goat was standing 15 feet away, and nobody saw it.
Wow.
As they were all just spellbound with this sudden view of the...
The first one that I saw, I thought it was a Great Northern boxcar.
Yeah.
Because I worked with them for about 30 years. They were on the side of every one of them.
They sure were. So I told them it'd be nice if they'd say good morning to the residents, and then they really went bonkers. But, so, let's pursue personal relationships and listen back to some of those words when we deal with some things like connectedness and the words of Chief Seattle. But we'll get to that when we get to the ecological relationships at the end. But I grew up, I was born on a farm in Iowa. I came out to the state of Oregon by the coincidence of the Depression taking away my dad's farm and he having to pursue a trade in the city. And it brought me to Oregon and I've never been back to Iowa. And that was 1941. I probably will never go back. Since I haven't seen every mountain in the North Cascades yet. If I do, I'll go back to Iowa. I grew up in the hills because we didn't have any money, but we had lots of love and all the values that a family, a tight family relationship and a Christian upbringing can bring you. So I went to the Columbia Gorge because that's as far as I could get on my bicycle and get to the mountains before dark. And I traveled alone from about the time I was 10 years old. And so I experienced a lot of highly personal relationships and made a lot of mistakes and learned very definitely the hard way what risk management's all about. But I also learned, I think, just fortunate for that experience of contemplation at a pretty young age and a study of inner self by studying what I saw around me that was remarkable. And I'll share one such experience, and there were many. I was at a place called Wadham Lake up the Eagle Creek in the Columbia River Gorge, very special place, and I had decided to spend the night in the arm of a large big leaf maple that extended out over the shore of Wadham Lake in a pretty wild side away from the trail. So I got in among the licorice fern and curled up and kept myself warm with a small tarp. And I woke up with the sun and lay quiet because I had learned by that time, I was about 12 years old then, that was the time of visitation by a lot of the critters. And for the first time in my life, saw a fox in the wild. And coyotes are common in that place, but foxes are not. And the fox came down to the shore and stood at the edge of the lake and looked around him or herself. I didn't know the difference or care. And he picked up a stick, and about a foot long, maybe an inch in diameter. And he started walking out into the water, but at almost an imperceptible rate. And he got into slightly deeper and slightly deeper water. And this took probably 2 hours. And I was asking myself what he's up to. And knowing I'd find out sooner or later, because nothing out there does anything by accident. And then as he got to the point that only his neck and then his muzzle was showing, and he started, I was going to say dog paddle, but I suppose I should say fox paddle, around the lake. His muzzle was covered with lice and the vermin that are attracted to furry creatures. And finally, with this tremendous, what we would call patience, because it would require that of us with all of the creatures now visible to me that they were in such abundance, got out on the stick. Nothing but his nose was above the water, and he then submerged and the stick floated away. Also with all of those vermin who had not near as nice a home anymore. And so it really caused me to, I think for the first time, and that's pretty young age to begin to really start to think about meaning of things rather than just enjoying newfound mysteries. I really began to think, and I often reflect back on that time I spent in that tree all night and then that wonderful morning experience on what I was all about. So it began early for me. And I learned, I think, these lessons: self-reliance, discovered my interdependence with nature. That's the risk management. You're not provided very many mistakes out there if you're alone. Hazard or wilderness can be hazardous to your health if you're careless. It can be very kind to you if you are understanding. Certainly the contemplation that came with the experience with the fox and many others. Decision making. I was confronted with the vagaries of weather and often was attracted to stay longer than my rations when I had particularly wonderful weather. Remember my principle, all weather's good. Some's a lot better than others. And I raised my family, and I'll talk about that later, to believe that when I found how we let weather dominate our choices, how foolishly we do. I don't think I'll go for a walk today, it looks like rain. It's a gray day. What kind of a mood does that place you in at the dawning of a morning? It's a gray day. And both grandmothers were into gray days, and I had to teach their grandchildren, my children, there were no gray days. Have to tell you, another personal relationship that came with that. Both of my children took very much to that as they experienced the same thing I did. We were in a supermarket in Bellingham, Washington. Now, Bellingham is given to some of that weather that's not as quite as good as others. And we're talking horizontal rain and the heavy doors of the Safeway being blown open and held open by the wind. And we come up to the checkout counter, and there's a nice matronly lady there, and she looks down at my young son, who was about 5 years old. And she said, "Well, young man, this is certainly terrible weather, isn't it?" And at which point he looked up at her with a wonderful innocence of youth and said, "Oh, no, ma'am. All weather's good. Some's just better than others." And she looked at me like, "Gee, it's a shame you got a retarded child." So she didn't learn the lesson he did. So what happened then, and I'll get to the courtship of my wife, who was raised in the city of Chicago and grew up then later in her teenage years in Portland and her college years. And she and I met after I got out of the Army by the darndest of accidents. And she had never really experienced the outdoors. It was not a part of her family culture. They were very much city people. And she had a very well-developed sense of the cultural things, good music, drama, dance, and was herself an artist. But I had something to offer her, and so we started our first year of courtship really in the outside. And I taught her the things I knew, and besides a very cheap date to go for a hike. And she was a very willing learner because she had a lot of years to catch up, and she understood that. And she caught up swiftly, and then I began to learn from her and her eyes and found that mine were not the only ones of vision. So we started with a mutual giving and sharing. And in fact, she translated much of what I had learned outside to music, which is just what you saw up there, that in music and in the harmony of music, and you said yesterday, Jim, that that you find that there is, when we seek harmony in nature, that we may find there's disharmony. I still am thinking about that. I find nature very harmonious. It's a hell of a climber, excuse me, Tate, but it is. There's great climber and vitality and dynamics, and maybe that's the crashing of cymbals but I find harmony in music that I learned from her to match the harmony in nature that I felt I saw. that all things out there do belong there for a reason. I'll get into some rather arcane relationships maybe
just
at the end of this.
Do you say there's also harmony in the city?
I think
if
so.
If you know enough?
Yeah.
Well, then there's harmony everywhere.
Yeah. I really think that's right. I think there can be. I live in a world of positives. I have a lot of trouble with negative things, and I like to turn to positives. But so then we, of course, became a family of a boy and a girl, and Jane and I. And because of my work is almost more than because of our avocation to go to wild places, they really kind of grew up in wilderness. We never went on a vacation. And the entire time my kids were home and before they went off to college and in their careers, we spent not just the summers, but all opportunities during the year to go to wild places connected with my work or otherwise. This anniversary, and you saw in the video that the act was signed on September 3rd, is kind of prophetic for us too, because we were married on September 3rd, 1956, and 8 years later, 1956, and 8 years later, in 1964, we were in wilderness, and for our eighth time, because we spent our honeymoon in wilderness and all subsequent anniversaries, in wilderness settings, we were at a campfire on the slopes of Mount Hood in wilderness when the Wilderness Act was signed. I'm very thankful for the Congress for being so thoughtful. But and President Johnson, so it's had that unique memory with us and relationship all this time. So it added to that experience. But bringing your children up in wilderness is to find the ultimate place, as I'm concerned, of being able to teach them self-discovery, self-reliance, to learn from them, just as I learned from my wife with her inexperience in wilderness. I learned from them the renewal of that thrill of discovery. As we grow into adulthood, some good things happen to us and some unfortunate things. One, I think we become embarrassed not to know things. We become intimidated by things we do not know. We lose that freedom to wonder and think and deduce, as children do, and to question. Too many parents get tired of the question why and how come and what's going on. In fact, answering those questions causes us to learn, and that's what I found out. That the real gifts that I had to give my children were a response to the gift they were giving to me with the question. They taught me one of my rules, and I'll get ahead of myself, but one of my rules, and that is to quit counting my adventures by the mile. And it's the most important advice, if it's advice or counsel, that I can give people that travel in wild places. Stop counting your adventures by the mile. How many times you talk to experienced backpackers and ask them, you know, where you been? Oh, I went from Snoqualmie to Stevens Pass, is 61 miles. Well, what did you see? Long pause. I learned that because I was young and robust and healthy and paid to cover long distances, and it did, and found out that the distance is irrelevant. You teach your children and learn then to manage fear. Fear has to be a pretty un-Christian characteristic if you think about it. It's interesting to me, all the Christian principles we all subscribe to, and that's trust in creation. That should be celebration of death, which is the beginning of life, but we often don't quite behave that way. In fact, we've institutionalized death into a very profitable business that is surrounded with sorrow when it should be joy. The management of fear is part of that. The discovery that wild places are not fearful, that they are inspirational, they are exciting, they're challenging. There is very little out there, particularly in the Cascades, that has any particular interest in damaging us. We only do that to ourselves with carelessness, so you learn to manage risk, but what you do first is to manage fear. And realize that by understanding the rules, and nature has very profound rules, and living with those rules when you're there, then in fact there is nothing to fear. Unless perhaps now these days a fellow human being, unfortunately. So, anything about personal relationships before I move on to spiritual relationships? Any reflections, anything you want to share? Any reactions?
I'm very interested in your Germanic background and your roots and what you said about the Germans and wilderness, where is a place where wild beasts were. We all know that the ancient Jews had the feeling that their God was the first because he was absolutely the most powerful. All other gods were second rate and should be exterminated. The Germanic tribes and some others in Northern Europe had a word for bear that was called the thing. The ancient Jews could not say YHVH. They said it 167 circumlocutions and they didn't say YHVH. It was just too terrible to say. They didn't say bear in some of the Germanic tribes. They said the brown thing. So bears were called Bruins and bears were called other things, but they were rarely called bear. And I was influenced by Hugo Glass. I'll not go into that, but he's the most famous mountain man that ever was. And they said, what did you fear, Hugh? He said, Indians and bears. So in a sense, we have the wilderness when the Indians and bears are tamed. And so we have the wilderness almost like a pet.
Maybe you could say some more about
Yeah. Yeah, it's, in fact, I don't like rules, but it's a way to say it. Processes really that occur out there, like the camp in an avalanche slope. But it's there because until the discovery takes place and you learn to see, then in fact dark places. In fact, we teach children dark places are scary. We sometimes use it as a weapon against them. The forest is dark. I'll get to another one of my rules: don't ever travel entirely during the daytime in wild places. Some of the most enchanting movements I've made in wild places are at night. And I'll tell you on the trail perhaps about a bug, what a bug is, because there's a way to travel in, out there without the electronics of today, the simple devices that miners use that allow you to travel and not lose your light, night vision, but also keep you from stepping off of precipices, which is desirable. But it's understanding darkness, it's understanding chasms, the crevasses in ice fields. So understanding those things, then you escape the fear of them. Understanding your own ability to deal with exposure, the fear of high places that many of us have. I don't experience it, my wife does, but it's most manageable. When in fact you begin to understand it's not the high place that threatens you, it's your own sense of exposure to it, and you learn to manage that. And so it's really that I'm talking about. It's taking certainly some of the mystery out of natural places by learning to understand that they have no particular interest in harming you. That there's nothing out there that really does. Unless you're in brown bear country. Now that's a new discussion. But they truly are omnivorous, and they probably include us in their diet, given the chance.
You call them the thing?
Yeah, the thing. And I know I've rarely been in the presence of brown bears only once in the North Cascades in 66. And a stray came across the Canadian border. And I want to tell you, your personal antenna goes up some long distance, and you become super tuned to all sound and all noise, and then therefore they give you quite a contribution to the experience, especially when you're alone, you know they're present, because other than that there's nothing in these mountains other than a bull elk in rut season that has ever given us some challenge. But that's really it, is learn by understanding. You can walk down this road at night if you like, or particularly down here where the timber gets tall and it gets particularly dark in the non-moonlight night, and ask yourself if you're sensing some fear. And if you are, then begin to examine why. Why would you possibly? What is it that is in darkness that causes us fear? I'll come back to that again about some of these personal rules of travel in wild places. Anything else, or we'll turn to spiritual relationships that I think I've discovered, values that I find out there. And I'll come into those on ecological relationships. And I think we'll get there.
Transparent, yeah. These more immediate dangers to perhaps future dangers.
You also suggest another thing to me, though, because I don't want to leave you with the impression that I'm only talking about the natural rules, which would pose a danger that if you expose yourself contrary to them. There are other things. It's like understanding where you want to sleep at night, or set camp, if you like. It's very foolish, and I have never camped along a lake. But the vast majority of people that visit these mountains for a wilderness experience are attracted to lakes. Okay, the natural processes that take place is that you get maximum cold air there, you get maximum humidity, you get maximum insects, you are not exposed to wind as you are in the high places, and you have maximum exposure to other people, and because they're attracted there. And so we never camped at a lake. In 40 years of backpacking, only three times have I camped at a lake, and one was the one I told you about, Wadham Lake. But that's when I was learning. And so the other two were emergency situations due to weather. We had to bivouac, and we had to bivouac where we were and prepare to stay through the weather. So there's another case where, you know, call them rules, call them phenomena, call them facts. You learn to react and respond to what goes on out there. And the greatest prevention of insects. If you want to escape black flies and mosquitoes, which are no great problem in these mountains, but if you want to escape them, that's the place to do it. You wake up to that inspirational morning sight. It's dry, and you pack your water to that site, and therefore you're away from people, because people in those mountains generally camp near water. So it's just another example. It's not only fear, it's the other aspects of being out there that you learn to absorb into your lifestyle while you're there, and they're the natural influences that you respond to. The spiritual relationships that I've begun to really identify for myself, certainly inward reflection. I found, as I think back, that much of what I have done in my career in terms of creative thought, of solution to wilderness planning problems that I've been given, where the boundaries are to go in that case, career decisions, including the one to retire, which I made here, as I mentioned, out on a snow pile up here above the piles. Important career decisions, life decisions, have all been made while I've been out in a wild area, and I've learned inward reflection or contemplation that's valuable to me. I think best there. Humility. If you get to know me well, and those people in the Forest Service, the many that do know me well, and I talk about humility, and they all start laughing. And it's not a characteristic that I'm sorry to say that easily flows from me. And in fact, I often get challenged up here, Bush, were you ever a drill sergeant? And in fact, I was. And so, but I have. I've learned humility and also awe. Some of it comes through in what Tom and I and the others did with this film. That is awe-inspiring. That is humbling. That's pretty difficult to think yourself very important or to think that your role here on Earth for the terribly short time in the system that we spend here is very important relative to the gifts of creation that you're surrounded with. And I have to go back to that sometimes because I'm very determined, very dedicated, and very aggressive in wanting to achieve the things that I think I should achieve in my career, and that can make me what I was described once by a regional forester in an introduction to a room of 300 people, a bull in a china shop of human emotions. And not really a title I want to wear. And so I've learned that. I've learned about myself. And I think that I was raised Catholic, as I mentioned, and I think there was largely a lot of dogma, a lot of rules, liturgy, and I went through Catholic schools through the high school level. A lot of it was not all that different than learning mathematics, and did not have a high sense of spirituality for me. It was what I was taught at home and then in the schools that I was supposed to believe. That was the true religion, the true relationship with God, and became very mechanical for me. And it was really freedom from that, not from the truths and from the principles and the spirituality of the religion, but the mechanics, I'll call them, of the religion. I was able to free myself from that and find the deep meaning behind all that, behind scripture, behind liturgy. I said once when I missed Vespers here a few years ago, and it just happened to be when they used to announce the new people at the village and at Vespers, and they announced Dick Buescher, and Dick Buescher didn't stand up. And so when I happened to be up the valley, and I was talking to a deer and coaching him into a position I wanted to record him in the camera. When I came back, everybody was giving me a bad time at the snack bar about missing Vespers, and I told them that they were in the wrong cathedral. And I really believe that. I believe that these mountains have become our cathedral, and I'm speaking for my wife and I now. And that's no rejection of institutional religion at all. I hope wise enough to understand that our belief and our spirituality is pretty fragile, and that collectivism of an organized religion is mutual strength, and gives us a better shot of staying on the right path. But I have found that freedom from the mechanics of religion as I learned them. I think the most important thing, though, that I've, two things, is a sense of oneness with nature by a lot of exposure and a lot of reflection and a lot of seeing and still learning every day. There's a new mystery that is revealed to me, or at least titillates my desire to find the answer. Is the sense of being one with nature and reaching that connected view that Chief Seattle talks about eloquently, or talked about. The words you read are not his, and I think you know that. They're a poet's translation, but the spirit of the words is there, and things are certainly connected. And it's interesting that the spider web that Linda chose on the cover of the document that they printed of the whole speech here, which if you don't own, you should, and I strongly recommend to you, that connectedness is the same thing that happened to be Tamarachi's picture, not mine, of the web when Chief Seattle was speaking on the tape. And the spider web is the almost perfect symbol of that connectedness. I found myself now connected in the web, and it was not always so. It takes time to know that. Well, if you find yourself connected with nature, then in fact you can find yourself connected with God. And that is the finding of God in the wilderness for me, that nature is God. Maybe the best of all words for me that we use to describe God is the Creator. because in fact all this is that great gift to us, it is life. The last spiritual relationship that's developed is speaking and listening to nature and therefore to God. I strongly advocate talking to animals. I do it partly because I'm a photographer and it very much eases the animals. There's a wonderful story in one of the books that Scott recommended, the one with the beautiful pictures, listening to nature. There's a wonderful story right at the end, and it's almost an anecdote by the photographer that took all but two of those pictures. And he found what I found and shares it, and that is the need to talk to animals to ease them, to make them conscious of your presence. And he talks of a photographer friend of his who was with three animals, I think deer, yes, and in a meadow, spent several hours talking to them to the point that they became so comfortable with him that they bedded down and they each chose one cardinal direction of the compass to face to protect themselves from danger, and deer do that, and they expected him to assume the fourth direction. And that's pretty ultimate acceptance, if that's a true story. I'll give him benefit that it is. And I can understand that happening. And I do a lot of photography of deer up here, partly because they're certainly not tame, they're wild, but they are more accepting of human beings than a lot of other places, so it's easier. But in fact, you still need to talk to them. Being able to communicate with nature, either verbally, mentally, through scent, and most definitely through listening, is a spiritual relationship for me. We'll move to ecological, which is going to be kind of it's going to be the basis for our hike after the break, and we'll continue it out there, but I want to set some understanding with you before we do that. But any reflection on the spiritual before we do that? Anything that you would share that is different or enhancing of what I felt?
Last night I was thinking about, I did a Bible study once on, where Jesus is in the wilderness the evil one asks him to turn stone into bread. And afterwards, Rudy Edmond, who's been our geologist here for many years, gave me this little book he'd written on turning stone into bread. It reminded me that that's where bread came from. All of life as we have gone through the stages of life and nature, life as we know it today was once stone on this planet, and that all the elements of life were contained in that stone. Anyway, that got me to reflecting on human history as we know it is what someone said: if we took the 365 days, we'd be the last hour or something like that. That we have come out of what we, as we look back into nature, we see things much older than we are. And that God has been involved with those processes since the beginning. And that somehow I had lost that some connection, and I think we somehow lost that connection to the human race. And as Christians, we've been every time we've tried to look back into nature, then someone is accusing us of being pantheists or nature mystics or something like that. It's almost like there's a barrier there. But in fact, we need to be brave enough to cross that barrier and say just what you said, that it's almost a return to listening, because somehow the deer or the bug or the mountain or the tree represents processes that go far beyond our human history that God has been involved with and can teach us. So I'm just kind of rambling here, but those are some of the thoughts that came to me last night.
That's interesting because Mirror reflects on that. And I have a lot of agreement with an observation he makes about lower and higher forms of life. There's an interesting paradox. The so-called lower forms of life, think lichens, bare rock, your rock, are in the highest places. And when you think of a mountain range, and as he did in the Sierra, and in fact he saw the so-called higher forms of life being those that are in the valleys. As you come down to the valley, of course, the forest becomes more complex and the trees are bigger, and there are many more forms of life, and we call those the higher plants and the higher animals and the vertebrates. And he places man down there, not in a superior position at all, but like all the other living things, they are the accumulations of, if you like, gravity, but of the development of life forms, man being just one of them, and being the beneficiary of the accumulation of all those things. The author of this...
It's not a contradiction, but I found a million ladybugs on top of one ridge one time.
Oh, you will. Yeah.
It's such a surprising find up there among the lichens.
Yeah, that's not unusual. In fact, collectors find them there. This Richard Cartwright Austin, I like this particular book. Reading Straight Mirror is great when you're looking for little things, but if you want to get some of the theology explained of Mirror's writings, this particular little book's a good one, and it follows this passage where he quotes some of Mirror's writings about this whole thing of higher and former forms of life and where he sees humankind belonging into it. He says, within Mirror's spiritual ecology, humanity is not at a lower level, but at a place different from that imagined by the enthusiasts of technological progress. In the evolution down to men and women, traces of all things are deposited in the human flesh and personality, all things. People, therefore, have the greatest potential for communion with all forms of life and with the earth. If that communion is realized, humans are the most divine, drawing, closest to God's own perspective and delight. And I think it takes you somewhere beyond pantheism, is that in fact it does place humankind not in a superior position, but in a position of highest gifts, and then a high responsibility to use those. Well, I'll not read Chief Seattle again because you've heard it so eloquently on the screen, but that connectedness is so much a part of what I've discovered in a long, fairly long career now in wild places. Another aspect of Mirror that I particularly appreciate is that he drew great spiritual nourishment from those things in nature, the forces of nature, which we consider to be catastrophes. And I talked a little about that language last night for those of you who were here, that we surround earthquake, flood, wind, fire, as catastrophes, as bad happenings. Mirror draws a point that the Old Testament used these forces and examples of these forces constantly to herald God's presence and to celebrate. In fact, there's a passage in the Bible that he quotes that talks about the renewal of the earth through earthquake. And in fact, Mirror would celebrate the flood and reflect that it would probably be reported only as the number of houses that were carried away, rather than the great transportation, the natural transportation of rejuvenation of a fertile earth. I get into a session I do here on natural processes, and I ask people to list the things that they think are I put up here, goods and bads, and I leave a column unidentified, which is neutral, and that's where everything always ends. But I ask about the bad things in nature, and I hear fire, and I hear flood, and I hear earthquake, and I record all those, and then pretty soon somebody said, wait a minute, you know, I've been reading in Sierra Magazine or National Geographic, the fire's not always bad, that, you know, the Yellowstone. So pretty soon, well, maybe it's neutral. It's bad when it burns the houses in Santa Barbara, but it's not bad when it burns in an ecosystem. It's a source of life. And so we start neutralizing everything. Everything gets neutralized except for one, usually, and when I do this, even within the Forest Service. The one, anybody want to guess what it might be? What force of nature? Erosion. Now, I think that goes back to our agrarian roots. And for every farmer, erosion is a taught evil, that erosion is loss of the topsoil, loss of the growing capacity, and so on. Well, any of these things are bad, fire included. Smokey's not dead. You know, he's up there on your wall. Human-caused, human interference with natural processes is what we're trying to not do, and certainly human-caused erosion is wasteful and is foolish. But I'm talking natural processes here. The people of Louisiana should be very appreciative of erosion because it gave them a state. It wouldn't exist without erosion. If erosion is bad, why is Grand Canyon a national park? Why do we celebrate the greatest example we have in the continental United States?
That's one damn sure stuff, the processes of nature in the Delta of the Nile.
I have that here. I have that when I start talking about the foolishness that we've done to interrupt those processes. We have such an egocentric perspective about nature that all these things which deal badly with our works of creation, our buildings, our towns, our highways, we place in an evil category, a destructive category. Mount St. Helens is a classic example. Talk to a wheat farmer 2 years after about the disaster of the ashfall of Mount St. Helens. Greatest thing ever happened to the dry wheatlands of eastern Washington, because it replaced missing chemicals that were needed in that soil to enhance growth capacity, but then much more important thing, that's dryland wheat. And what it did is reduce the evaporation rates. And so this whole egocentric approach we take to nature, I think you have to overcome. And in fact, you have to recognize the connectedness. When we exercise it with all the power of our technology and our science and all the rest, we have done some really funny things. Tragic, funny in the wrong sense. The Forest Service identified wildfire as an enemy. And we took on fire with not as much success as we like to claim we did. But we did interrupt some natural role of fire. The natural role of fire in the Yellowstone has never been affected by humankind. That's nonsense, because those are very long-term intermittent fire cycles of over 200 years, and we haven't been fighting fires for 200 years. But in this very forest around us, there are short-term, low-intensity fire areas like the Inyette, a range a few miles to the south of us, where we have interrupted the role, and so we built and exacerbated the fuels buildup. To the point of the downwood and deadwood buildup, so to the point that we now experience unnatural fire. So this whole idea that wildfire was an enemy was wrong, and in fact we exacerbated natural processes to the point that they did become more destructive of our things. They don't destroy anything in nature than they should. Well, we're learning that, more stuff. Think of how we treated the redwoods. We fell in love with those magnificent trees, their bigness, their beauty, the groves of the redwood. Keep that word in mind. There's a reason why they're groves. So what did we do? We organized as a Save the Redwoods League, and we created the National Park to Save the Redwoods. And you know what we achieved? We doomed the Redwoods. The Redwoods cannot replace themselves without massive flood and fire. We dammed the Eel River and the other rivers of Northern California. I'm talking about coast redwoods now. And we have, of course, found the massive fires that redwoods require to be unacceptable, because we live among them and we have parks among them and we harvest timber among them and around the parks. And so for our children's 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 children, which we nobly said we did all this, we in fact have guaranteed there'll be no redwoods within the Redwood National Park. That'll all set itself straight, so don't concern yourselves. But our action was interesting to me. You cannot preserve, now I'm at that word, this preservation of wilderness, the Wilderness Preservation Act, preserve the redwoods. You don't preserve things. Trees are living things. And I told one group here a couple of summers ago when we got into this, that if they were going to turn to preserving ancient forests, I would ask them to work first on preserving ancient foresters, because then I would be a direct beneficiary. And then some woman who was quite astute says, I see your point, they are living things. And I said, of course they are. They're being living things, and being ancient, they're about to die. What you preserve is their right to die and their right to procreate and for the whole system to keep going on. But the idea that you're going to preserve the redwoods is absurd, and in fact you can doom them by denying the natural processes. Fortunately, all those lands being ravaged by logging, and which are shown to you in dramatic pictures to encourage you to send money to the Save the Redwoods League so we can have more parks, will be the places of the future redwoods. Just go and look and see. If you go to the Lady Bird Johnson Grove, I'm particularly taken with that one because I know Lady Bird Johnson, and I went to see this grove that she told me was so marvelous. Just outside the grove, the largest trees are Douglas fir, and they have replaced redwoods already. And redwoods and tan oak, or Douglas fir and tan oak replace redwoods, because redwoods don't come from seed, they come from stump sprouts, that's why they're in groves. And many of those groves, five or six large redwoods, came from a single massive tree that was killed in fire. And you can see all of it there when you learn to read it. If you go outside into those, and I agree, they look terrible, those large clear cuts on industrial lands outside the redwoods, you'll see all the redwood sprouts coming up from the stumps, not Doug fir and tan oak. Natural relationships between blister rust and white pine, we're going to see these on the walk. We took the poor boys of the CCC, put them in camps in Idaho, and gave them the job of grubbing the ribes plant out of existence. Wonder. Hundreds of thousands of acres. The most futile ambition of foresters that I've ever known. The idea being that since blister rust finds a host on the ribes, or flowering currant, ribes sanguineum, it has to have the ribes plant to be able to grow in one life form, so it transfers itself to the ponderosa pine and does what we see up the road, kills them. And it was the most valuable timber tree. Remember that timber tree? So now we're into utilitarianism in nature. We were going to get rid of all the ribes, and ergo we would get rid of the blister rust, and then we'd have all these beautiful pine trees that we could cut and make boards out of. And in fact, of course, we failed miserably. But in the meantime, natural processes are growing resistant, disease-resistant white pines, which of course had to exist, or white pines wouldn't be on the earth, because the blister rust didn't just show up, it'd always been there. We tamed the Nile, your point, Jim, with the Aswan Dam, where the Russians did for the Egyptians. And in taming the Nile, we destroyed a shrimp fishery and a whole lot of other things at the mouth of the Nile that was dependent on all this flow of nutrients out to sea. And we created liver flukes and lots of other very undesirable things by managing nature unnaturally. We've created monocultures in the forest, unfortunately, the resilience of nature overcomes our monocultures, and she or he plants exactly what should grow in those systems despite our best efforts. Monocultures are foolish because they're of course very fragile to the other forces of nature, breed insects, disease, and all those other things that belong out there. Only have a single culture, a single tree, in that case Douglas fir, to work on, it's far more susceptible to eradication than if you have multiple species, as you'll see up the road. We viewed, and this is back to a certain element of Christian doctrine that drove Gifford Pinchot and like-thinking early foresters, Christian utilitarianism, that in fact the gifts of creation were placed on the earth for us to utilize wisely. Wise use was the definition of conservation. Wise, but use. And not all bad, just inaccurate. We viewed deadwood then, and it was taught to me 35 years ago, a dead tree was a wasted tree, that a good forester captured the death before it occurred and utilized it, and therefore eliminated waste. Waste was a very unchristian thing, we viewed, when in fact the dead elements out there are essential to a healthy forest. And we'll see that as we walk. We learn they are essential, and that in fact a dub fir contributes in its normal life cycle about 800 years to the ecosystem in terms of a place to live, a conduit for nutrients and moisture, transformation of chemicals that are usable for other plants and vice versa. So it serves as a functioning member of its society, of its ecosystem, for about 800 years, and then it dies. And it may remain standing and it may fall depending on why it died and the circumstances. But standing or down, it serves another 500 to 800 years with gifts to the system. And we usually hold this session, it's harder to do this with Columbus, but it's very easy to do this, and I suppose we could with Columbus, with Martin Luther King. I equate that when we used to have our wilderness spirituality session on the day we commemorate Martin, with his life and the life of all of the great members of our society that we attribute large gifts to the rest of us, that in Martin lived a very short time on this earth, in even the terms of humankind, and yet is still contributing, much like the Doug fir of the ecosystem, and we are all connected. So, I'm going to demonstrate out there to you just this phrase. We're still learning ecology one page at a time. And I confront this all the time at my wanders about the national forests and dealing with the men and women of the forest service that we're passing the responsibility onto. And we cannot continue to learn at that slow process. We're brighter than that. And we have to speed up the process. We have to learn ecology much faster than one page at a time. And we'll look at that. Let me close with your friend Sigurd Olsen and Mirror. And it caused me to reflect on all this. First, John, I have a low opinion of books. They are but piles of stones set up to show coming travelers where other minds have been, or at best signal smokes to call attention. No amount of word making will ever make a single soul to know these mountains. As well seek to warm the naked and frostbitten by lectures on caloric and pictures of flame. One day's exposure to mountains is better than cartloads of books. And it's with that, remember, he was quite an author. but point well made, because we'll see that as we wander out there. What you and I will share out there, you perhaps can find science to explain in a book, but that's a poor way to experience the knowledge that nature's got to teach us if we read the ultimate textbook, we read the lamp. Lastly, this whole meaning of wilderness, and in reflecting back on what you saw in the film, what you've seen in your own experiences in wild places, and listen to what I think really is probably the best reason that I've read for making wilderness, in making the expensive decisions to make wilderness in the United States expensive in the terms of commodities foregone and values foregone. We are trying to bridge the gap between our old racial wisdom, our old primeval consciousness, the old verities, and the strange conflicting ideologies and beliefs of the new era of technology. It is here that wilderness will play its greatest role, offering this age a familiar base for explorations of the soul and the universe itself, by affording opportunities for the contemplation of beauty and naturalness, as well as further understanding of the mysteries of life in an ecologically stable environment. It will inculcate reverence and love and show the way to humanism, in which man becomes at last an understanding and appreciative partner and with nature in the long evolution of mind and spirit. And I think Sigurd got it right. So, in the few minutes we've got left, what thoughts?
Your comment about, or John Drew's comment about all the books and how we haven't learned from them versus seeing them out them. People at Holden and people at St. Martin's Village have millions of slogans and Hallmark cards and whole books of quotations. And I sometimes smile, a slightly superior smile, and say, all those quotations have never kept us from a single act of human folly.
Yeah, I read in those words, and of course I've learned lots in books and in some of these, that only cause me to see better. And that's the real gift. And that's why I think he's right about there are stones on the pathway, and they allow you to see and feel and hear and learn what someone else saw, and use that as a base for your own learning. Not to accept that the pages of the book gave you knowledge when you're talking about the wild lands out there. They only, for me, intrigue inspection and cause me to chase my own interpretations. Who else?
I'd like to ask you about your apparent defense of clear cutting. If nature ruled that fire might be the natural way of forests going and being restored, and having been to Yellowstone earlier on this summer and seeing all the burned trees standing up with the burned outside, and imagining the rains falling and the snow falling on them, I can imagine that the action of the rain and the snow is taking nutrients or something from these rotting trees back down into the soil, which must be, if you do clear cutting, be missing, and that all you're accomplishing with clear cutting is producing cargoes of books.
Yeah, you're exactly right. My prediction is clear cutting will not be a viable tool of harvest on the national forest within 5 years. It's going to be sooner than that in California. They've already made the decision to terminate it as a viable practice. And that's a good observation, Robert, because, it's another one of those myths of forestry. I'm writing a paper for the dean of the School of Forestry, which he has not solicited, is entitled, The Truths of Forestry You Taught Me at Oregon State 35 Years Ago. He didn't, but they did. 35 years ago, which have become the myths of forestry in my career of practice. They've also invited me to teach down there, but they may read the paper and fire me. But probably not, because they're changing too. It was a simplistic notion that natural fire kills trees, creates an opening, and the same species, Douglas fir in this case, lodgepole pine in that case, return in that wonderful place that we also made as a nice dining room for deer by stimulating plant growth, which didn't occur underneath. It was all half-truth. In fact, Sayuslaw Forest, where I started, was the most vital forest in the world in terms of growth potential. Wonderful place, fantastic trees. The theory being that a big fire came along, burned all that stuff 100 years ago, and now we have a 100-year-old forest. Utter nonsense. It was a series of fires. And in fact, it did exactly what you said. And if you've been to Yellowstone, you know they didn't all die. And in fact, it's a mosaic. And there are dead and down materials. It was also followed by wind preceded and followed by wind, which put a lot of that on the ground, which became instant protection for small mammals, for plants, nutrient recycling, all kinds of things we know now we didn't know 35 years ago. And so it's a complicated process, and we have to emulate the complications of the process. There's a term, new forestry, that's come out. I'm going to talk Monday as we close about my sense of my positive sense of the future, how we're going to turn ourselves around, and part of it is the perceptions of the new perspectives of forestry in terms of forest land. But we simplified everything because it was convenient and it also fit that utilitarian desire. Clear cutting is not an emulation of a natural process. It's that simple. And therefore, in my mind, it doesn't belong on your national forest. I think that the art of forestry, and that's what it is, it's the artful application of a little bit of knowledge of a bunch of natural sciences that we're still pursuing. That's my definition of forestry. The art of forestry is got, again, to speed up. We can't learn ecology one page at a time. But the fundamental fact is we have to emulate nature. I believe no chemical belongs in forest management. Because unless it's a natural chemical. And if it's a natural chemical, you don't have to add it, like nitrogen. You have to keep the plants that add it.
Wasn't Agent Orange an absolute tragedy?
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the most disgusting things in all of human history.
Well, yeah.
What we did to the forest division.
But I'd suggest that some of the things that we've done in the guise of good forestry are not all that different. They just had a different motive. But there was still a lot of foolishness. To be dependent upon our concepts of genetics, when in fact the creator is a master geneticist, is foolish to me too. To make great investments in fertilizer after denying natural fertilizers is foolishness. And that's what recycling's about around here, that there is no waste in nature. I'll give you one example and then we'll take our coffee break and we'll assemble in the courtyard and 11 o'clock?
Yeah.
At 11 o'clock. Just one example. All of you have enough, I suspect, enough roots in the land and in farming, though I was sharing with Scott. My social scientist told me a startling fact the other day, and it is a fact that 80% of the people in the United States are second generation urban dwellers. They don't have immediate roots in the soil or the forest. They have them in asphalt and concrete. And that's why we've had to change a lot of our communications with the public. We used to use thinning carrots as an example of why we thin trees, and I remember a woman asking a silviculturist what he meant when he said thinning. And he said, well, like in your garden, when you thin the carrots so that some carrots grow to be large. She said, I've never had a garden. I've never seen a carrot grow. And so, you know, all these old retreats to agrarian examples don't work anymore. But how'd they get off on that?
We're too far from the country.
Well,
and no longer know what farmers do.
Yeah, okay, but back to this. Yeah, I know what it was. The one principle that's not obvious out there to you and wasn't obvious to us is the role of smoke in the environment. Now, it's real easy to come up with the role of down logs and decay, going back to nature, replenishing nutrients and making homes for little creatures. But smoke, isn't smoke just a problem with human health and a nuisance and all the rest? Or as I say in the Willamette Valley, a signal for the Oregon State football players to start practicing. Otherwise they wouldn't know it was football season. Smoke has a lot of relationships out there, and most of which we probably don't know yet. We knew that it would provide a particulate matter for raindrops and snowflakes to coalesce on. That was simple. We knew that smoke was a translocation of nutrients, that in fact in the combustion process nothing is destroyed, back to physics, that in fact it's just reformed and it goes off like the ash from Mount St. Helens and becomes somebody else's benefit. But what about this one? We found, I think 10, 12 years ago now, with an arcane piece of research some weird scientist was chasing, that smoke is pathogenic to the spores of wood-rotting fungi. Now, something should be. There's something pathogenic to everything out there, including us. And so, you know, all living things die, and something has to cause death, but the wood-rotting spores of wood-rotting fungi, wood smoke is pathogenic. So it controls. It is a control mechanism. And so, it to me, it's the most remarkable little piece of knowledge that tells you again and again and again, reminds us again, nothing out there is wasted, unnecessary, or can you do without. The Forest Service reduces insects to pests, forest pests. The only part of our outfit that deals with insects, management part of our outfit, is entitled Forest Pest Management. You've all heard about the spray programs for bark beetles and went off for bark beetles, can't spray for bark beetles, for any of the defoliators like hemlock looper and currently spruce budworm. We aren't hurting those creatures at all, so don't worry about it, folks. We're keeping the chemical companies happy and by spending lots of money on them, and we're solving an American trait. It's what I call the why can't somebody do something syndrome. We had it during Yellowstone. Why can't somebody do something about this terrible fire that is devastating Yellowstone National Park? And so we did. We spent about $70 million of the taxpayers' dollars to put on a great show that protected a few buildings and didn't bother the normal course of those fires whatsoever. The fire scientist over there says, we spent $70 million to put on a show for those people that thought something should be done. We really hope they enjoyed it. And so this whole idea of why can't somebody do something is why we spray bugs. It's just like, we just can't let all those trees die without doing something about it. But in fact, the only something you can do about it is to live by the rules of nature. If you exacerbate the forest setting by leaving breeding materials out there in unnecessary or unnatural levels, then in fact you ought to do something about that, obviously. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about natural insect population expansion. Used to call it epidemics. I'm careful with my language anymore. And was always known as insect epidemics. They're not. They're just natural explosions of populations that rise and fall with the system. So with that, let's go have some coffee and take some time off, and keep thoughts and questions in your mind as we get out into the real world. And we'll just look at some things together and do some discovery. And I'll try not to be a teacher, but a coach.
One final important question. This wonderful place where I had coffee up here for 20 years, some of the branches is dying. Is that natural or what?
We haven't made any decision about
it. Don't cut it. If you cut it, you're acknowledging that a dead tree is a wasted tree. And if you leave it, you're leaving wildlife habitat.
And if it falls on you, it's an act of God. On
that's right. And like Sam said, you've got a high question.